This program is presented by a community producer through Midland Community Television. The City of Midland and MCTV are not responsible for the content of the program. The views presented do not necessarily represent those of the City of Midland or MCTV. If you would like to produce your own program, contact MCTV at 837-3474 or access our website, cityofmidlandmi.gov/MCTV.
Local productions seen on Delta College Public Media are made possible with support from viewers like you. Thank you.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Junior Doan's The Spark. I'm Junior Doan. My conversation today is with eminent British historian, author, and former professor at the University of Exeter, Jeremy Black. Welcome, Jeremy. What is history?
History is the account of our past. It's about human beings, as opposed to geology, which, as it were, deals with the inanimate past, the past of the planet without human beings.
And what is the purpose of history?
Oh, that life exists without necessarily any purpose. We're talking to each other, we're having a pleasant time, but there isn't some master purpose underneath it. No, I mean, I think to try and explain the past may interest some people. Some people might just like a nice story. Some people might have a political or social argument they want to pursue through the past. There's no one reason to produce history, just as there's no one reason to go and see a film or to read a novel.
What I liked about going through a few of your books is that you managed to incorporate values and experience in different, sometimes as an aside, burial practice. I just enjoy that a lot. But my quarrel with history has always been very subjective. And what I say is, in my lifetime, I have seen the American culture change. It changes, in my opinion, every 7 years. There's a little different emphasis. Now, right now, it's not a little emphasis, big emphasis. But how do you carry, if that's true, if it's not 7 years, it's 10 years or 20 years, how do you research the nuance of that, which then impacts values and decisions?
Well, first of all, you're absolutely right. There is an element of the subjective. There is no one account of the past. By its nature, you cannot repeat the experiment, which is what you can try to do in science. And because you can't repeat the experiment, we're dependent on the evidence that survives from the past. And it's rather as if there's a mirror, and it's rather as if that mirror has been broken. And a lot of the pieces have fallen out and it's swinging in the wind. And that's what we can see of the past. By the nature of things, we only have so much evidence. But that doesn't mean that what is the interim report, which is what history is without value. The problem is that too many people think that they can have a definite answer. This is what the past says, which, what a surprise, is what they want it to say. The reality is we need a sort of humane skepticism, not cynicism, but skepticism about our ability to understand the past or indeed each other.
I have read that history is a sort of prelude to the present in some way. A, do you agree? And B, what we're living through now, wokeism and, you know, this kind of thing, does that sort of correlate to an earlier period? In your opinion?
Let's take the first one and then we'll come on to the second. History is a prelude to the present. Well, what I would say is what we're all really interested in is the future, but we don't have a data set for the future. So the data set for human beings, both in terms of whether you're trying to learn something from it or because you want a good story. The data set is the past. And there's nothing wrong with that, as long as you realize that the past is the past. It needs to be understood in its own terms, and it won't be automatically repeated. Now, you asked the question about what we call wokeism or wokery. I think a lot of it is very silly. A lot of it is very what historians would call presentist. In other words, instead of trying to understand why people made decisions or choices in 1950, 1900, 1800 and earlier, what people are trying to do is say they should be like me, and if they're not like me, they are wrong. Well, that's just stupid. That is just a very narcissistic account. And I would say that that is narcissistic, whether it comes from the left or the right politically. I used to be, I've now retired, but I used to be what you would call a full professor of history. And in order to try and explain this to my students, I would, in the first lecture, and we used to film our first year lectures so that those who were ill or lazy could at least have something to look at on their computers. I used to say, well, let's make it easier for your great grandchildren. I said, I eat meat. Most of you eat meat. But maybe your great grandchildren would think that was appalling, some kind of atrocity. So why don't we all stand up in front of the cameras and apologize for eating meat? And I said, you can see why this is a ridiculous idea. You ought to judge an age in its terms of its own values. So it's entirely reasonable if we live in Britain or America today to be contrite, apologetic for something that we have done, which is wrong. But it's ludicrous for us to be apologetic for something our great-grandfathers or great-grandmothers may or may not have done just because somebody else today thinks it's the wrong thing.
I think the only thing you have control over is your mind and your mouth. And while you're alive, and that's what you should, an action, and that's what you should be judged on. And this whole relevance and this and that, I think it takes people away from the moment, you know?
Yes.
We are living history to be, right? Tomorrow is, you know, today is history for tomorrow. Anyway, you get the point, and I sure thought about it. What really grieves me about America, and you write it at the end of one of your books about that, the tension, and really that there's more interstate rather than intrastate violence and war. And we are living through something like that in the United States, where there's this tension over who are we and what were we and what are we told we are now to be.
Yes, you're absolutely right. One of my books forthcoming is a history of America. As you may know, I've done a series of national histories. So I started with Italy, then Portugal, Spain, France, Germany. And of course, at the very beginning, I did Britain. And I've got one on America coming out. Well, I've already got my copies, so it'll come out in America, I don't know, in a month's time. And it's very interesting to see what in some respects is a continent pretending to be a country. In other words, the experience of being American is not identical in Hawaii as it is in Vermont or in Alaska as it is in Alabama. And it's interesting to think, well, how as a historian do you try to shape that? And I think, you know, it's the third most populous country in the world. There's over a third of a billion people living in the United States. So not surprisingly, there are different views about past, present and future. What I would say is breaking down at the present moment. It's not the first time there have been breakdowns, but what is breaking down at the present moment is the willingness to accept that somebody who doesn't share your point of view may themselves be a full citizen and, you know, is entitled to express themselves. And I think what's the problem is that there has been a sort of loss of democratic consent. And you can see that in, for example, political correctness in the universities. You can see it in the way in which The judicial system is used in order to push through a particular political or governmental legislative program separate to Congress. You can see it in a degree to which people are happier to socialize with those who share their own values. Of course, many of those characteristics were also true in the past. America in the 1800 election, in which Jefferson narrowly won over Adams, there was the thought of military moves at that stage to ensure a particular, whether Jefferson won or Jefferson should lose, there were thought of military moves. The history of the United States, as you would expect of a society in which people are are educated, they are free of their views, they're used to living in a non-authoritarian context, and many of them have chosen to move to America in order to be free citizens. It's not surprising that people often have very different views about what should happen. I think the questions now for America are quite serious, but then many other countries have got very bad political issues. There are very serious political issues in my country, in Britain. I was giving a lecture in Spain earlier this week. Spain is in political crisis. What happens in France after Macron is very unclear. Germany is in political crisis. So I'm not convinced that necessarily the Americans are worse off. And in some respects, they are actually in a stronger position. American economic growth is greater than that of most Western societies. America doesn't have a regional separatist movement. It actually has a very interesting position in which it has very high personal ownership of guns, but without that leading to social breakdown. So although there are serious problems for America, and I discuss those in my history of it, there are also factors which need to be seen in a broader context. And that, I think, is interesting. And it sometimes can be very difficult if you live in a country, it certainly is true of the British, to move away from what's going there and to look at it in the broader pattern.
So my thought on this is the following. I'm very American, and I'm proud of our country. I think it offers a range of opportunities and behavior. When I was in my early 20s, I wanted to see the world because I wanted to adapt my life, or whatever, see how countries lived. And so I did do that. And I came, one country was better in this way and that way and so forth. When I got back to the States, I said, nobody, no other country that I personally have visited can offer what we offer, good and bad. But countries are made up of humans that are good and bad anyway. What I noticed is that the greatest generation sort of messed up on their children, and that cohort then became very rebellious in the late 60s and early 70s. Don't trust anyone over 30. Anyway, their intent was to break down society. And so they did, in essence, and it's still happening. But there was always the tension between the Judeo-Christian backbone, the Ten Commandments. And I feel, until recently, when I declare hedonism the winner, but then hedonism was fighting with the structure. But as you say, you have to have some structure. So now we've been in this sort of loose period for a while, but the structure we're now getting, as in everybody's a racist and whites are bad, I don't think that's a helpful structure that supports freedom of mouth and thought and expression. So I'm puzzling and would love your comments on it. What are the options now?
Yeah, first of all, I think you're absolutely right. The notion of white privilege is a stupid notion, as many white people are in the United States, as in Britain, are poor. It's a ridiculous idea. The idea that there is axiomatic racism and defining society, again, is absolutely stupid. So I agree with you entirely on those points. The question is, how do we move forward, and how does one achieve democratic consent in divided societies where there are serious economic strains? And the answer is that, in a way, is where you need skillful politicians. And you also need to work out how those politicians can take a considerable constituency with them. Now, obviously, you've got two politicians of the older generation who are currently the front runners in the presidential race. And at the present moment, we don't know what's going to happen. At the present moment, it looks as though one or other of them is going to win. What's more interesting, if you're thinking about America's future, is to ask, where is the next generation of political leaders going to come from? What values are they going to have? And how are they going to address the problems of the present day and of what is coming forward? And I'm not clear whether at the present moment another generation of political leaders who are up to the task is coming forward, either in the Republican Party or in the Democratic Party. I'm not clear whether that's the case. I don't know. And I do notice that an enormous amount of the discussion is about the gerontocracy. It's about people who are my age and older, and there's nothing wrong with us, and I'd like to keep going for a few years, thank you very much. But I do know that the future depends upon another generation. Now, you make a very good point that there was a loss of direction, a incoherence of hedonism, from the 60s onwards. I think that's very true. It's not just the case in the United States, of course. You could also see that in other countries. It was more generally a crisis of the West. And I think it's clear that there are major problems in economic circumstances, because what you need to do in all societies is to get the young to become acculturated to being good citizens, to working for themselves, to not becoming dependent on the state, and for having some sense of law and order and, as it were, values. And a lot of societies seem to be finding that extraordinarily difficult. So quite clearly, it's a problem in the United States, but it's a problem elsewhere as well. And I'm not quite sure how we move forward on this one.
Shine a light on it. And that the search for justice, which is equality, right? Everything has to be identical. Is really a substitute for tyranny, because the only way to make everything identical is to put someone in charge who will therefore allocate or determine or direct or something like that. So where is this coming from? Who leads this? It's certainly not in the academic community where it's K-12 or higher. In fact, people who go to college really get ruined somewhat, because they end up disappointed or mad at America or something. But it starts much earlier now.
I think you're right. I think there are many problems. I mean, I try and discuss this in my brief history of history. I think there are many problems with educational systems at the moment. I think it's worth bearing in mind that a lot of people are going to college and doing subjects like medicine or dentistry or engineering, and are not necessarily, plotting the destruction of American society. I think the specific problems that we're addressing are the humanities and the social sciences, and we're addressing how you have an anti-ethos in those ones. In other words, a way in which society is held up for permanent criticism in accordance with the political agenda. And you see the same thing in Britain. And in essence, what is remarkable is that this has been going on despite the fact that, you know, the other constituencies involved in higher education, whether it's donors, the employers of graduates, the parents of students, the people paying for the degrees, government, are on the whole not particularly happy with what's going on. So there's something particularly bizarre about the educational system, particularly the higher educational system, in both the United States and Britain. And it's almost a travesty of freedom, because it claims a freedom of expression, but the only freedom of expression allowed is a freedom of expression that accords with what is regarded as acceptable norms by a small political constituency. And that's not very healthy, because if you truly believe in diversity in universities, then universities should have conservatives as well as liberals. They should have people who are supporters of capitalism as well as people who are critics of capitalism. And unfortunately, there are relatively few conservatives or capitalists in the university system.
Yes. I just say yes because I'm thinking, okay, he's described the system of where we are well, and where's the hint of how you develop, or how do these people who are not leaders but see they should be leaders, or somebody ought to be a leader, you know, how does that come forward? Because when I talk to people, a lot of people are willing to moan, but very few are willing to consider, okay, you know, we're Americans, let's solve the problem. What are a couple ideas that you have, I have?
Well, I certainly think, number one, I think you might well benefit from differentiating between degrees from the point of view of grant aiding them. So a degree that clearly has a functional value to society, you can understand why the taxpayer should be paying for it, you know, dentistry, medicine. I'm not clear, I mean, you know, take my subject, history, I'm not clear why it benefits society to have a vast number of people doing history degrees. And within that context, I think you ought to be cautious about funding degrees which are non-utilitarian.
What do you think about foreign money in universities? Is that good, bad? That they donate, set up schools or whatever.
Well, first of all, I mean, obviously, if by foreign money, what you mean is, shall we say, Nestle investing in trying to have some food science research done in, let's say, you know, an American university, that's not inherently a bad thing. If by foreign money, what you mean is trying to buy political outcomes, that's obviously not good at all.
Well, I'm reading it's sometimes hidden. Anyway, that's a side of it. What drew you to history?
Oh, I was quite a serious child, rather a lonely child in one respect. And I went to the local public library a lot and read lots and lots of history books. And I was really fascinated with history by the time I was six. And then I started to write the history of an imaginary king country. I read an enormous amount of both history books and historical novels. I was very good at it at what you call grade school. And then it just seemed obvious to me to go on to do it at university. I was also interested in geography, but history was the subject I was interested in most.
And how did you come to decide on the area you concentrated on?
Oh, I was originally an 18th centuryist, and that was the area that I'd specialised in by chance factors at my last year as an undergraduate at Cambridge. So I then thought, well, I might as well do research on it, and I sort of fell into it like that. I don't have a master plan. I'm completely useless from that point of view. Indeed, when I was interviewed in 1995 for my second chair, the one at Exeter, one of the outside assessors said to me, well, I was already a professor. What are you going to be doing, Professor Black, in 5 years' time? Meaning, what would I be writing? And I said, I don't know. I might be run over by a bus this afternoon. And he said to me, you cannot live your life on that basis. And I said, that is exactly how I live my life. So I don't have a master plan, I'm afraid.
You know, I worry about trust. I worry about when I was growing up, my grandfather, there was your word is your bond. So if you agreed to anything, especially in business, and you said you were going to do it, you did it. You didn't need the contract and everything like that. So we're not there. We're here where every little word in the contract counts for something. So that's okay, somewhat. But I just seem that there's not respect for telling the truth. That's why I say the Ten Commandments are sort of vague, you know, they remembered, but not thought about, of holding yourself to a certain, or even Rotary. Is it true? Is it good for all concerned?
Look, As a conservative, it's very easy for me to go in for declinism. In other words, it was always better in the past. But let's be clear. Are you really saying that somebody like Joe Kennedy, who was a master manipulator of the 1930s, I mean, he was awful. There were lots of bad, and the same in Britain. There were and France and other countries, there were lots of dishonest people who might have said their word was their bond, but quite frankly, it wasn't. I think it's hard to work it out, to be frank. I think it's hard to assess how societies get better or worse. There are, as you know, global indicators, and some societies seem to decline rapidly. South Africa, for example, is in a terrible mess in terms of public probity and corruption at the moment. But I'm not convinced necessarily that your society is 100 degrees worse than was the case in your grandfather's generation. It might seem it, but it depends where you were. I mean, there were lots of parts of America 80 years ago, 90 years ago, where you wouldn't have really wanted to do business. I mean, unless you were in some political patronage network. You know, after all, let's think, 1950s, Virginia, if you're in the Byrd machine, you're going to get, you're going to get contracts from the state government. And if you're not in the Byrd machine, you're not. If you were in Kansas City, you have to be in the Prendergast machine. I'm not sure necessarily things are worse. They may be no better. But they're not necessarily, it wasn't necessarily that the past was fantastic.
I never say that. I talked about one quality of behavior amongst people because of the activity, the standard they held themselves to. And how do you bring that back? Because we're entering fast the AI age and all this thing that it says it's going to change us. But we don't want to lose our human spirit. But human could be really horrible people.
I agree with you. Yeah. Now, listen.
So therefore, if we ever have.
I'm coming to an end, as you know, of my 26 and a half allocated minutes. So let me just say to you and to your listeners that ultimately the best way to understand a historian is to try and read them. And I have always tried to write for the general public and not the academic world. You know, I've done some books which are monographs, but a lot of the time, yes, like that book you're holding up, A Short History of War, published by Yale. And lots of my books have been published by American publishers. There are my books on James Bond, on Agatha Christie, on Sherlock Holmes. There are my.
This one too.
Yeah.
Anyway, Jeremy, where I just want to sum up. So here's a man who took his life and relentlessly studied, must have a fabulous memory, but he has the ability to communicate and reasonably so. You don't have to blow up Buddhas with him, to have your way. He's open-minded and he makes his points well. And if you ever have a chance to grab one of his books and try them out, please do. And I don't really endorse books, but his is worth reading. Just for the thinking process and your appreciation of the human condition. So go out and do something kind. This is how I end every session. Do something kind for someone you know and someone you don't know, and repeat it every day. Thank you, and see you next time. Thank you, Jeremy. Appreciate it.
To contact Junia, send her an email at juniadonesthespark@gmail.com. For more information, program schedules, and news about future guests, go to www.juniadonethespark.com. Thank you for joining us. See you next time on Junia Dones The Spark.
Local productions seen on Delta College Public Media are made possible with support from viewers like you. Thank you.
This program is presented by a community producer through Midland Community Television. The City of Midland and MCTV are not responsible for the content of the program. The views presented do not necessarily represent those of the City of Midland or MCTV. If you would like to produce your own program, contact MCTV at 837-3474 or access our website, cityofmidlandmi.gov/MCTV. We hope you enjoy the following presentation.